Thanks, Tony. Tony has talked to me several times, in fact, over the past year about coming over here to give a colloquium, and we couldn't do it. And then we were both in the rec sen trying to slow up the rate of decline, I guess. And he said, well, no, come on January 5th. And that was before this big earthquake that just took place on December 26th. And so I had sent in the title even before then, and of course I should change it, of course, for obvious reasons. There are other reasons that they can be more dangerous, but in fact we knew about the hazards due to tsunamis for a very, very long time. But I don't think it would be right not to talk just at least as a preview, just 5 or 6 slides indicating what happened in Sumatra, basically, where you have a magnitude 9. This is the largest earthquake we have had since the Great Alaskan Earthquake in 1964, which happened to occur on a Good Friday. It also generated a tsunami in which people, basically, if you've ever looked at Anchorage or movies of it, you can see that Anchorage gets wiped out for the most part due to a local tsunami, and people were killed in Crescent City. I was reading in the LA Times that the people knew it was coming. And at that time in 1964, the two people in charge actually decided against warning the public about the tsunami because their fear was people would go to see it. And of course they would, and that would be, of course, then more people would die. And so, but this was a tragedy that is still unfolding, and it brings to mind just how dangerous earthquakes can be. It is not the worst tragedy in terms of loss of life that has occurred recently, when we say, with even the last 30 years or so. The worst tragedy that has occurred was in 1976. There was a magnitude 7.6 earthquake in Tangshan that killed officially 250,000 people. They all died within about 8 seconds, and that's the unofficial estimate was as high as 650,000. Nobody really knows, but we'll take it at 250,000 with 1.5 million injuries. It was unbelievable, and this one looks like it will be about the same. What happened at Sumatra? Let me back up just one before I get off here. What I'm showing then is the outline of the world, of course. It's broken up into what we call these tectonic plates, which I see that Jim over here says, stop plate tectonics. Okay. It's a good idea, try it. But what happens here is that in this arc here, we have subduction. Okay, what we have then is the Indian plate being subducted underneath this is not the European, it's the Eurasian plate, and this plate in here. And so we have this whole group of islands in the Indonesian arc, and there are just lots of things going on here. But the big thing here is that we have a large subduction zone. Now what we mean by that, because some of you are probably not geologists or seismologists, but what's happening then in the Indian Ocean is that there are regions around Antarctica in which new material is coming up, generating new ocean floor. This ocean floor then is moving off rather slowly. In this particular place, about somewhere on the order of about 6 centimeters per year near Sumatra. And then this is being subducted beneath. You can imagine that this is Sumatra, and then what happens is that you've got this subducting plate going down. This region in here, down in here it's too hot, it's ductile, it flows. And up in here, though, you get brittle failure. And so what happened in this particular earthquake is that we had a large magnitude 9 earthquake in which the subducting plate moved relative to Sumatra on average 10 meters. The vertical uplift is on average about 2 meters. It stretches, as I will show you, for 1,000 kilometers. It's huge, this earthquake. So when you look then at a subducting zone, again, you'd have to turn this around, but you can imagine Tonga being like Sumatra, one of the islands. And so what happens is that the land is on this side. Now what also is true that causes the tsunami, of course, is the fact that you have a sudden vertical change in the elevation of the seafloor, or sudden change in the elevation. So this puts the water above it then out of equilibrium. And so in order to come back into equilibrium, we generate, or the, not we, but this process generates a tsunami. Now, looking over since 1990, and actually only back to 1992, if you look at 10 recent destructive tsunamis around the world, 5 of them are in the Indonesian archipelago. In other words, and there was a recent one here, the New Guinea earthquake, Papua New Guinea, where 2,000 people died, you know, just washed over the island. And so this area, of course, is exactly what you would expect, where if you're going to get a disaster due to tsunamis, of course, this would be the place. You have large subduction zones, you have everything low-lying. If you generate a tsunami, you've got large run-up. Most of the people live near the coast. All the things come together, the confluence of the factors. So what happened in this earthquake? Well, the epicenter is located here at the northern end of the island of Sumatra. The aftershock zone extends from here to here. It's about 13 degrees. So we're looking at something on the order, you know, over 1,000 kilometers. This is the seismicity prior to this earthquake. In other words, we've got lots of earthquakes along the Sunda Trench. In other words, this is a very active region, but not that active in the sense that 6 millimeters per year, or rather 60 millimeters per year, is okay, but that's not an enormously high rate. It's sort of middle range for many of these subduction zone regions. But this whole region broke. Okay, so the rupture starts here, breaks starts here, and propagates. And unlike what was the subject of my talk, this one propagated, as far as we can tell, rather slowly, about 2 kilometers per second, at least over half of it. There's not much resolution up in here, and I will come back to explain why in a moment. But these are the aftershocks. About 2 days ago, there was a magnitude 6.6. About once every hour or 2 hours, I get another alert saying there's been another 5.6 earthquake in the aftershock zone of this large event. If you superpose the aftershock zone of this earthquake on two places, one will take California. This is what it looks like. I mean, we're not talking something that is just, you know, going to affect us like Northridge or what's right underneath us, though that would be bad enough. Okay. I mean, Northridge right down here you could hardly find, probably underneath that S. It caused $40 billion worth of damage. I don't know what an earthquake like this would cause. On the other hand, if you were to ask in the United States, other than Alaska, where could we have a magnitude 9 earthquake? There is one place, and it's been forecast for a number of years, and that's here in the Pacific Northwest. The Juan de Fuca plate is moving under the Pacific Northwest. It goes from Cape Mendocino all the way to north of Vancouver Island. And nothing's happened. I mean, they've had a few small earthquakes, called magnitude 6.8 small, up in here in Washington, but they have evidence from Japanese tsunami records for a tsunami that hit Japan at the time when the paleogeologist would argue that this is the last time this broke, basically January 26, 1700. And they have tsunami debris in Japan, which would correlate with this, in which you would get something above a magnitude 8. But here's a magnitude 9, and in 1986 or 87, Tom Heaton and Steve Hartzell made a forecast that, in fact, should this go in one rupture, you would, in fact, generate a magnitude 9 earthquake. And you can see it's the right size. I mean, it's been quiet now for 300 years. For those who don't know, I'll go through this really quickly. I took this from a slide in my other class on geological catastrophes. But basically what happens is that with earthquakes, and you need earthquakes that cause some sort of vertical motion. And I will point out that the type of earthquakes that we get right here in the channel is exactly that type of earthquake. In other words, there was a reported rumor of there's good anecdotal evidence of having a tsunami here in 1812. It is something that we actually have to worry about. So what happens is that you're going to have a thrust faulting event where the hanging wall moves up. You basically put the mass of water that is above, because all of a sudden this was level and it jumps up. You change the elevation of the seafloor, and now the water basically is out of equilibrium. Two things happen, or at least one thing happens right away. The tsunami splits, okay? You're going to get one part that travels out across the ocean, that part which hit India and Sri Lanka. And then you have the other one, the local one, that basically hit Sumatra. This one doesn't give you very much warning time. They had 10 minutes or less. In Sri Lanka, you have 2 hours. And so these things travel then, because they're, you know, these are the long wavelength waves, they travel then proportional to the square root of the acceleration times the depth of the ocean. But basically, when they're traveling across the open ocean, they're traveling at about 500 miles per hour. So the this then is the epicenter off of Sumatra. This then is going to be an animation done by the Pacific Tsunami Center. And you'll see the tsunami generated here. You'll see it very quickly gets into Thailand in about an hour. And you'll see it basically, because of the arc, it just almost focuses the tsunami at Sri Lanka. So the wave comes off. This is in about 2 hours, it's hitting Sri Lanka, comes off like this. It diffracts around the tip of India. Still traveling across, will end up getting to Africa, of course, after some time. The energy is dying in the amplitude of the waves, but it's still pretty big. The islands are getting hit. I have heard very little about what's happening out in here at La Réunion, where Kaiaki is. But this happens, and so the whole Indian Ocean goes off like this. There's no dissipation. It's the theory is, yeah, they derive it as the long wavelength approximation. So it's basically the whole mass of water is moving as one with one large wavelength, and it just drags across the bottom. So if there's any friction at all, it's only at the bottom until it finally gets to the top, until it gets across. They do that. That's how the simulations are being done. In other words, these are they're calculating.
Simulations could just as well put it in phenomenological.
Oh, they could have, but you can calculate the tsunamis. I don't have it with me. It's not, but I looked it up, and you calculate what the tsunami wave will be, other than the generation. In other words, the biggest thing here is how you're going to generate this over this arc. Because the rupture, if you're going 1,000 kilometers at 2 kilometers per second, you've got 500 seconds of energy being dissipated. So it's not all at one time that this earthquake occurred. This earthquake itself takes basically about 6 minutes before it ruptures from one end to the other, because it's not traveling at our supersonic speeds or super shear speeds. So the in the travel times, when you're looking at this calculated, this is calculated by a different person, Kenji Satake in Japan, and I'll show his simulations. But what happens is that you can see that after 1 hour, but in 30 minutes, you've already covered everything. So the islands like Nicobar and Andaman Islands, they never had a chance. In other words, those islands and the northern part of Sumatra were already swamped at the time of the earthquake. Now, if you have a magnitude 9, and you're not exposed to tsunamis, know very little about it, you wouldn't expect it. And besides which, surviving a magnitude 9, you'd be counting your blessings. And yet at the same time, they get wiped out because of this huge tsunami. You can see that it's plenty of warning time, and they would have had plenty of warning time in Sri Lanka. In other words, they would have had 2 hours of warning, almost 2 hours of warning. They had plenty of time to basically alert the authorities to get people off the beach. But that was not true in this, you know, there's no warning system there. Now this is the, this records the time at the top as it goes. This is already at 10 minutes and it's already covered the islands. And so the, you know, just breaks out. But mostly you get a better idea of, you know, the waves are just coming across. They tend to, this is the thing, they tend to form up in here and sort of slosh back and forth. So certain parts look like they get hit a little bit harder than others. Well, like I say, in 1812, Santa Barbara experienced a local tsunami. Mbari did a very detailed bathymetric map of the Santa Barbara Channel. What they found was a very, very large submarine landslide directly off, you know, to the south of us here. And this landslide is dated as 1812. So in all likelihood, the tsunami that was created was not caused by the actual lift of the elevation of the seafloor by the earthquake, but was in fact caused by a massive landslide on the coast. And that also can happen on the continental shelf. Pardon?
Santa Cruz.
Oh, no, out here. This is Santa Cruz. A couple of meters, but a couple of meters on a low-lying area, is a lot, and it's not apparent that it went. It definitely went up Winchester Canyon far enough to cross Highway 101, but how much of it affected downtown Santa Barbara, it would depend. Now, if we get the magnitude 7.5 earthquake, which we are capable of producing in the channel, we have a fault that comes across right about here. Then we have it steps inland and comes into Santa Barbara right about here, the Red Mountain. This is the North Channel Fault. And they can link up. They actually come on land at Peters Point, and they continue inland basically towards Ventura. If you combine that total length and the total down dip extension, you can produce a magnitude 7.5 earthquake. And it's capable. Earthquakes, they do not stay on one fault. They're not constrained to do that. They actually can jump and link faults. So it's very likely that this could happen. Yeah, I saw that. I talked with Larry Parsons today about that. The thing about it is that you have the possibility of it coming in through the slough, on the airport side. You have Devereaux side. Luckily, we're at about 60 feet elevation, and the tsunami height is definitely tied to the size of the earthquake. We don't expect to see one much more than basically 15 feet, 3 to 5 meters. We're certainly above it up here. So we're going to stay high and dry. But there are lots of low-lying areas that are not. And certainly the port, the harbor, Santa Barbara, if you extend it further down, it will not be the case.
The shallow one versus the deep trench.
Oh, the thing about it is that you need to change the elevation. The big trench earthquakes, the thing about it is that you just have a much larger area that is coming up. And the thing here is that in this particular earthquake, it's area and the total elevation change, because you're then able to displacing more mass. And so what happened in Sumatra, because the trench is actually off the island is sitting back, the dip of this fault is only about 11 degrees. It could be even shallower. It's maybe 8 is the focal mechanism. It may be 11, it may be 8, but they're very, very shallow, so they extend way back, so you're just lifting a huge amount. And it extends down dip maybe 150 kilometers, so it's a very big earthquake. So when you go to consider then seismic hazards, which was the purpose of when I talked with Tony, what I talked about was, okay, all the elements that go into a seismic hazard calculation, there's a whole list of things that you have to consider, okay? Everything from where the earthquakes are, how often they occur, what your local site effects happen to be, whether or not, how fast you happen to be loading the plates, how often should you expect the large earthquakes, etc. The thing that comes out of it in the end, though, is that you produce an earthquake. And when you produce the earthquake, what you're producing then is a fracture in the earth, a propagating fracture, and in the case of Sumatra, a fracture that doesn't seem to want to stop until it's traveled 1,000 kilometers. A lot of earthquakes don't do that, thank goodness. But nonetheless, the question is as they propagate, the question becomes, how fast do they propagate, and how, what's going to happen on any given fault in a given earthquake? And that's going to then lead to the ground motion. Now, SCEC, the USGS, the California Geological Survey, have all produced a seismic hazard model for Southern California, and the red zones are what you think. They're the regions of highest hazard, and the thing about this red zone is that it's a little bit out of date. It should move a little bit on land so that it covers right over Santa Barbara, but basically it's near where the big faults are. And in fact, I should point out that what most people do not know is that if you had to name the two metropolitan areas in the entire United States that are most at risk, you of course would name San Francisco and Los Angeles. They have the highest seismic hazard. The third highest seismic hazard anywhere in the United States is Santa Barbara. So we sit in a very exciting place, quite honestly. Well, let's get on to super shear ruptures. The first evidence for a super shear rupture in an earthquake was the 1979 Imperial Valley earthquake. Occurred in October of 1979. A rather, moderate-sized earthquake, magnitude 6.6, initiated south of the U.S.-Mexican border, propagated mostly unilaterally, triggered slip of magnitude 5.8 on the Brawley Fault, And we had lots of stations that we could then look at the data from. And from these data, we could infer what we thought had happened during the earthquake. And in doing this, the model that I derived had that we had a large amount of strike slip offset at depth, most of it buried below 5 kilometers. But the thing about the Imperial Valley earthquake that caught people's attention, I never thought it'd get through the review, it did, is that there are regions, a fairly substantial region of the fault, in which these are contours of where the rupture front is at equal instants in time, each second. And there's a large region in here in which the rupture is traveling at a velocity that is greater than the local material velocity. In other words, it is traveling super shear. So, and before, almost all brittle theory, you know, theory for brittle fracture would indicate that the maximum speed that you would have expected would have been the Rayleigh wave velocity, 0.9 times the shear wave velocity. But this stayed this way for a long time because it was a kinematic model. It was only recently that Pascal Favreau, who was here under the auspices of the Keck Interdisciplinary Program in Seismology and Materials Physics, that Pascal and I looked then at the dynamic properties where we took the slip distribution. From that, we inverted to get a stress distribution on the fault. We imposed a fracture criteria, which is slip weakening. I'm not going to go into all that. But then we let the rupture propagate spontaneously. Now, the difference between the kinematic models and the dynamics is just that. In other words, the dynamics, you allow the forces to dictate what the path of the rupture will be, how fast it will propagate, and you let it take over. In the kinematic model, the rupture velocity, the slip on the fault, at every point on the fault is specified. But in doing that, what we see here then is there, we have to look at these on our side. So I'm going to be showing lots of pictures somewhat similar to this, though different orientations. But what I have here is at each second in time, it's like we've taken a snapshot of the fault plane. Now, I've turned the fault plane on its side, so the surface of the Earth is here and depth is here. And we're going along strike, so zero distance, let's say right above the epicenter is here, farther north is up here. So the rupture then propagates it this way. Now, on these, each one of these snapshots, what I'm showing then are the snapshots of the slip rate, how fast the two sides of the fault are slipping past each other. And there are, you can see that the rupture, there's a clear rupture front. This dark blue is not ruptured. Behind it, where it turns blue, it's basically healed because it had ruptured at some previous time. But what you get from this is that you see that the slip on the fault doesn't occur, first of all, the whole fault doesn't go at one time. It's not an instantaneous rupture. It propagates. And it propagates very much in the same way that if you were to take a rug and tried to pull it across a room, what you would do is that you would first form a fold in it and then push the fold across. And then the fold, at the end, you'd have some net offset, but you would basically, you'd get it across. There's a lot less friction. And this is basically what you see in the ruptures, is that there's only a small part of the fault that is really participating or slipping at any one instant in time. Large parts of it are very quiet. Well, the part that hasn't ruptured, obviously, and parts behind it actually stop slipping. But in this region, we see that the rupture front, in fact, breaks out. We start to see it here, and then all of a sudden now we have two, basically, fronts. There's one here, there's another one behind it, and then they catch up later on. What I'm showing here is the stress drop, but this is how the stress is changing. But if you were to look then at depth, choose a depth here at 11 kilometers, and plot the rupture velocity along strike, what we find is that the rupture velocity in some parts of it is greater than the shear wave velocity, shown here as this dark blue line. It's greater than the square root of 2 even, which is another magical number. And in fact, at this one point, you know, locally, it appears to jump to the P wave velocity. Well, this, you know, was okay, but Landers was another big earthquake in which we looked at. And if you look at the Landers earthquake, this is a magnitude 7.3. Lots of aftershocks triggered a big magnitude 6.6 aftershock on the Big Bear. But the Landers earthquake was really interesting because it jumped many different faults. But still, when we tried to do a model where we basically made this into one fault, which may not be realistic, actually, but we did it, and we look at these same sort of snapshots, if you look at any point on the fault and ask, well, what's happening, you can see that the Landers earthquake was one of these earthquakes that basically almost died. Okay, it would have left itself as a magnitude 5 if it had not kept going for longer than 6 seconds. But once it started to build up speed, all of a sudden now, this rupture is now sweeping out over the entire length, about 80 kilometers of rupture, and it will sweep out the entire fault plane. And this is showing the intensity of the slip rate again, where you see these very, very bright spots in the leading edge. And if you look at the average rupture velocity from the epicenter to the north, from southeast to northwest, the average rupture velocity is somewhere near 0.9 times the shear wave velocity, a very reasonable, you know, Rayleigh wave speed, sort of limiting velocity. But if you look at how these patches evolve, you can find that locally, the way it goes on, in fact, the rupture is much faster than that. And that's what I want to show you, I hope, in this next movie. It sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. The hand is on there, so we're in luck. But if you look at the rupture, it doesn't just spread out sort of radially across the fault. It bounces. You know, I mean, and so locally at any given point, it's possible that this rupture is in fact going much faster than the local velocity. And so you get this idea that you can actually have super shear rupture velocity. If you plot then contours of slip, of the slip amplitude or slip rate amplitude, the particle velocity, either on the fault or that, there's something that came out that we had not noticed before. I certainly had not noticed, even though Kim Olson, who had done these simulations, had made these plots a long time ago. And that is that what you notice is this arc that comes back like this. Okay? Very, very much like the bow shock, you know, if you're on a boat. And so I was looking at this and I thought, yeah, it's pretty clear that there must be some indication. Why aren't these, this is not what we would have expected. We would expect different radiation pattern from this rupture. But this is very characteristic of what we see in the Landers earthquake, indicating, again, that probably it's going super shear, as I hope to show in a moment. Now, as you saw in the title slide, when I'm about to turn over to here now, my co-author was totally unaware that he was also going to be here giving this talk or helping to give the talk. But Eric Dunham has been looking at this problem in much more detail. And we got some encouraging news when you think about getting super shear. It's one thing to say, well, we inferred that by the laborious tricks that we use in seismology to infer what's happening on the fault. It's another thing if you can get direct experimental evidence of the effect. And this is what we have from Rosakis and his group at Caltech, in which what they've done is that they nucleate a shear dislocation in a pretty thin piece of unusual material, plastic, but it's loaded, and so what happens is that the rupture will then propagate, and it propagates in this way, and what you're seeing then are the S waves that are radiated. The rupture tip is right here, it's got an intensity factor in front of it, okay? And this is at the same period of time, they've made a slight change to it, you know, so that they can get this effect. But now what happens is that you can see that the rupture tip is out here, and you get this very clear Mach cone, indicating basically that the wave is traveling fast, the rupture itself is traveling faster than the material waves, than the velocity of the material waves. So we've got this Mach cone that's coming off, okay? And so this propagation is coming off like this. And this is one of their, this is in their paper in Science, it's a beautiful paper. They actually show basically how you get initially, you know, things are very copacetic, everything's moving as you would expect. You start to generate a second rupture ahead of the main rupture, just like we'd shown in the case of Imperial Valley. You see this sort of, this blip out in front. And then pretty soon you have then a full-fledged another rupture which is traveling at super shear, and you have another rupture that's coming behind it. Okay, there's still energy behind it. And this sort of thing is what we're seeing then in terms of seeing waves that are then traveling. The rupture position as you move along goes like this, and all of a sudden you see the break, it's much steeper. It's traveling much faster than what you would predict for the slope for an S wave or a Rayleigh wave speed. Well, this is work from that Eric and Pascal Favreau and Jean published in Science as well. And they looked then at what would happen, how do you generate these super shears? In other words, left to its own device, you know, the energy that's carried in the rupture front, it should propagate as a sub shear. But something has got to provide more energy into this system in order, and it must not do that, it must overtake the rupture front to in fact push this rupture front to make it a little bit faster. In other words, increase the stress intensity factor ahead of the rupture front in order that you can then generate a super shear rupture velocity. And this can happen, as Eric and Jean and Pascal showed, that what they did is that they had an asperity that was behind the rupture that failed after the rupture had passed through. So basically there was a stuck part on the fault that you can imagine staying there. It's not quite broken. The rupture goes around it, diffracts around, continues on, but then this breaks. And when this breaks, it then also emits Rayleigh waves and shear waves, P waves, which are of course faster than the subshear rupture velocity. So they will overtake the rupture front. And they in themselves will then generate stress intensity factors that now, with a stress intensity factor that basically is a conversion of a scattering of P to S, you can get this large intensity factor which wants to accentuate or aggravate the rupture front and push it faster. In other words, it will add to the intensity factor so that it will then propagate even faster with the speed at which it's coming in from this asperity that's broken, and it overtakes it. So basically you're adding energy into the rupture front. It meets the yield criteria. Now it says, I don't have to wait until the rupture gets there. I meet the yield criteria, I fail. And this is what happens in this case. Now, getting back to what happens then with regard to the ground motion, which is really important to us as seismologists and those who worry about what's going to happen to our buildings. When we looked at subshear rupture velocities, which has been basically the litany of seismologists for a number of years, that ruptures would be subshear, there's one characteristic of them that has really been, and it's well documented in many earthquakes. In other words, it's not hard to find really good evidence going all the way back to the 1966 Parkfield earthquake, that when you have a subshear rupture velocity, you will in fact stack energy in the forward direction, and that energy is strongly polarized because of what happens in seismology. The force couple system that represents the dislocation is a double couple, and the energy that in fact is really stacked is the energy that is perpendicular to the fault trace. And so the ground motion that you would predict will in fact be mostly perpendicular to the strike of the fault. Now, these are simulations and results that come from Eric, in which he's considered then a steady state 2D rupture that's propagating. This is the breakdown zone in here. The extent of the fault in which slip is occurring goes back to here. But right here at the crack edge, which at the crack tip, you can see a very, very strong component of ground motion that is perpendicular to the direction in which the fault is propagating. And this is something that we've known about for a long time. It's called the directivity effect. And it's predictable in subshear rupture velocities. And the velocities can be very large, but the one thing else that you will notice here is that the velocities are very large near the fault, but of course with radiation damping, they die as you move away from the fault. In supershear, it's different, okay? First of all, the ground motion, as you can see, is becoming much more parallel in this direction, has a lot stronger parallel component. These then are the waves, these are then S waves that are propagating off the fault, but because the rupture is now propagating super shear, of course they're behind where the position of where the crack tip is. So these waves then are propagating out, and you can see then if that is the direction of propagation moving like this, these the polarization of the ground motion is basically trying to get perpendicular to, you know, or parallel to this line because the direction of propagation is like this. Now, the other thing, though, is that is very different and which is going to cause a lot of problems if we experience supershear ruptures, and we think we have, and that is that we see no attenuation of the amplitude of these waves with distance from the fault. In other words, what we're going to get then is very large amplitudes even far from the fault. We're not going to see what we would, you know, this nice decay out in like we see over here, but along this Mach front, this wave that is propagating at the, you know, at the velocity of the shear wave, we're getting large amplitudes extending far from the fault. And this is in fact what causes at least me to have a lot of concern now about the idea of how often are we going to see super shear rupture velocities. There's a curious phenomena that occurs when you cross this very important boundary, the square root of 2 times the shear wave velocity, and that is the direction of the polarization changes. In 1.3, the arrows are pointing in this direction. Now they're pointing back towards the source on this side and opposite on this side. But again, what we see, though, as you get to larger velocities of the rupture, now the field is almost entirely parallel. Now, this is something I can assure you that we had not seen in earthquakes in the past. Most of the time, we have, in fact, seen primarily strongly dominated perpendicular ground motion close to the fault. But this is not what happened in the cases I'm about to show you in Denali. And before doing that, this is a nice movie that Eric put here. And what will happen is that the rupture velocity will increase to about 1.9 or so. And you'll see the mock shape of this change as this rupture moves. Very good way to illustrate. But the thing about it is that the vectors go like this, and at these very large values of the value of the velocity, you can see it's almost all parallel, and there's a very large, the entire field, most of the motion is then parallel behind it, and it's then parallel to the rupture or to the Mach cone in this region in between the two ends of the fault. But again, large ground motion extending far from the fault, which is not what we were looking for. Well, where do we see this? Does it happen? Yes. I mean, Imperial Valley is okay. One could always go back and argue over and over again whether or not it's really observable, but we were lucky, or in many ways, because we had a magnitude 7.9 earthquake in Alaska in November of 2002. Nobody died from this earthquake, which was fantastic. And unfortunately, the USGS had pulled out about 10 instruments about 8 years before because they couldn't maintain them due to cost. That hurt. But what happened was that this was one of the faults that had been identified in the building of the Alaskan pipeline. So these PS things are pump station 11, 10, 9, 8, keeps on going up. But what they do is that they follow from the Port of Valdez all the way up to the North Slope. They follow the Alaskan pipeline. And so we have one record that is really, really close to the fault, pump station 10, that is right here on this magnitude 9 earthquake. Now, this was a really interesting earthquake because this earthquake was initiated by a magnitude 7.2 thrust fault right in here. The thrust fault occurred first, runs into the strike slip Denali fault, triggers the Denali fault, which then ruptures for 350 kilometers. It's a sort of thing that, the reason for the study, of course, if you look at the last great earthquake in Southern California in 1857, ruptures a magnitude 7.9, starts at Parkfield, ends up in near San Bernardino. Basically, this is the Denali fault, starts off with a thrust fault, ruptures here, breaks onto the Tishunda fault, and this basically has about the same length as what we would expect for 1857. Well, the pipeline was built right across it. The fault comes right through here. And the thing about it is that it worked. Their design, they estimated that you could get 20 feet of displacement or offset, and that's basically what it got. It got right at that number, so they were lucky that it didn't go off. They built it with these Teflon sliders. So, and they also allowed for these kinks in it, or for the fact that they allowed that there would be some compression or extension during this motion. So they actually designed for it. They put it on these Teflon sliders so that it would slide back and forth, and so that they could keep this pipeline together. Now, did it work? Yes, it did not break. It saved us from an ecological disaster. And I don't know what the price of gas would be if you were losing the, I think it's 10 million gallons a day or something that comes off the North Slope. But you can see that they hit the stops. In other words, this is the pipeline on the sliders, and it's all the way over to the top, and basically it was moving really rapidly. Okay. And again, these sliders are again parallel to the fault. So this ground motion, people expected the ground motion to be perpendicular along the length of the pipeline, not parallel. But this isn't what happened. This thing was sliding like crazy, very rapidly, running into the barriers. Well, The slip at the pipeline, this is the Alaskan pipeline, is about 5 meters. So they had a large amount of slip that was occurring, and the Susitna Glacier here, so the pipeline is over here. Denali Fault's a huge fault. I mean, it's just enormous. Well, what did the data look like? Okay, so the particle velocity of this particular station is shown here. The normal, this is given in meters per second, given as a function of time. Normal to the fault, we have the blue line. And a meter per second is large ground motion. Okay, a meter per second, you put them into a lot of our buildings on campus, and we're going to have trouble. Okay, but then you look at the parallel component occurring at the same time, it's huge, 1.5 meters per second. Not only that, the normal component, the velocity, you've got this big pulse in here, another big pulse in the opposite direction, and the parallel component's not doing very much at all. Now, I had shown this when we first got this. First of all, it's a long story, but basically this record had to be corrected because the way it was recorded, and the USGS did a fantastic job of getting all the data about that particular instrument, making all the corrections to produce this result. And we were really confused, and I could not believe this parallel component. And it was Eric, in fact, who suggested that, well, that could be due to super shear. And lo and behold, this is what will come out of this, is that the super shear rupture is in fact going to contribute to this very large pulse, the parallel component, as we've seen before. And then these transient diffraction effects are the effects basically of the sub-shear rupture that is coming behind the super shear. And so Eric then spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to make a model that we could then, at least, if not, it doesn't prove, but at least it's consistent with the data. And so what we'll have then is we're going to have a rupture that nucleates here at the intersection where the Susitna Glacier Fault intersects the Denali Fault. We're going to let the rupture propagate along the Denali Fault. Now, between here and here, we're going to have a region in which we elevate the stress. So we have sort of an asperity that, in fact, can then generate these other P waves and S waves that can overtake the rupture front, causing a super shear rupture. And we had a number of different models. The very first model we had was one in which we allow the entire 10 kilometers of the rupture the entire 10 kilometers of width to break. We have a rupture then that's propagating. It does become super shear, as you can see here. So we've got a super shear pulse, and we have also this transient effect, the Rayleigh wave velocity traveling behind it. The location of pump station 10 is shown by this dashed line. And you can see that, okay, what it will then experience is the super shear will come through first, followed by this Rayleigh wave or transient effect that comes later. Problem with it is that it gets the time correct for when it arrives, but it's way too broad, okay? On the other hand, it does show that the Rayleigh wave coming behind is in fact going to produce the secondary pulse on the normal. It's also going to produce the downward dip that we see in the data as well. But it wasn't quite good enough. And so what happened is that we had to consider another type of model in which we had to allow for the fact that we were going to heal the rupture. In other words, we're going to make the pulse narrower on the slip rate. It will still generate a as you can see here, a super shear rupture that will propagate on by. Gets to have some very large values of velocity, slip rate on the fault, maybe unrealistically high. But as it passes the pump station 10, we have a good separation between the super shear part and what is the trailing edge or the transient effect. And with this model now, we can basically find a way that will fix the fault parallel velocity. It generates of course, on the fault normal as well, but it's also giving us, you know, this effect back in here where we get the two pulses on the fault normal, which are still fairly large. But you can see that the fault parallel motion is basically, you know, almost nothing once that goes by, which is what we would expect. And the other possible model that's consistent with that is that instead of healing, we simply allow a limited amount of the depth actually to be rupturing, and we get a similar effect. And I wanted to show you what interested me from the viewpoint of ground motion, because Model 3 and Model 2 look very much the same. This is looking then down on the fault, okay? And so we're looking along the strike of the fault. And what we're doing then is looking at the, we're looking down as if you're flying an airplane along the strength. Here's pump station 10. And you see the rupture at different instants in time as it passes on through. Now, the fault parallel velocity is very, very closely tied to the fault. Very large amplitudes though. This is given in meters per second. So the amplitudes are very, very large, very close to the fault, and these amplitudes are coming off in this direction. So we've got very large amplitudes that are going to come off of the fault at a very good distance, you know, 5 to 10 kilometers. The fault perpendicular is also going to be large. It also has this very characteristic Mach cone shape as it's propagating by. The amplitudes, though, are not as large. These are values that on occasion we have seen. But at the present time, you know, most of the time 2 meters per second is plenty. But these sort of numbers would be extremely damaging to most structures, because most engineers have never ever thought that they were going to design for something like 5 meters per second. In fact, 6.5 meters per second, it's about one third of the worst case scenario of Yucca Mountain with a meteorite impact, I think. Well, to show you what happens then if we take this Model 2, what I'm going to show, this is looking again, we're looking along strike. Here's pump station 10. So we'll see the rupture nucleated. So we're looking as if we're looking right along the strike of the Denali fault. And you'll see the rupture propagate, and you'll see it jump to super shear as it, so it's taking off. And pretty soon you'll see this will bifurcate. You'll get another leading edge pretty soon. It's starting to pick up. And there it goes. It's going by, and you can see how it generates then the ground motion as observed at pump station 10. And likewise, on the fault normal component, you see the same thing. You get to see how the second pulses are generated basically by the trailing edge. In other words, yeah, this will go with this, okay, so they're not lined up in the same way. But as these two come through, they generate basically the red giving you the positive and the blue giving you the negative. Still slightly out, but it's consistent at least with the really strong elements of that data are in fact the strong parallel component and this double-sided pulse that is very large on the fault normal. Well, I have two final slides. And that is to say, well, what about Southern California? Okay. Are we likely to see super shear velocities, and do we have regions which are big enough to produce? The last big earthquake to hit Southern California was 1857. Okay, this earthquake is ruptured from Parkfield, came all the way down and stopped here. It overlaps into here, but it basically came almost to San Bernardino. Now, there's one other place that, you know, everybody talks about this one because when people in the paper, that's what they know about. They say, when is the big one? The big one in Southern California is a repeat of the 1857. That is not what the seismological community is concerned about at the present time. That's not true. We are concerned about that in a very definite way. But there's another major, major concern. And it's down here in green. This section has broken, both in 1857 and 1812, up in here in the Mojave segment and through Wrightwood. But on the Indio segment that comes off of the Salton Sea, runs up past Palm Springs, breaks across through the San Gregorio Pass, and comes again onto the Mojave segment of the San Andreas. The last break where they can they've correlated from paleoseismology different trenches across the fault, saying that this is correlated across, so the length can be about this amount. It last broke in 1690. So let's say 1700 to make my calculation easier. But the thing about it is that it's accumulating slip at the rate of about 2.5 centimeters per year. So we have 7.5 meters of slip accumulated on this segment of the San Andreas, and it is not broken, and it is really quiet. I mean, you don't find small earthquakes, you don't find almost anything on this segment of the San Andreas. So when Landers hit, people got really concerned about stress transfer onto the San Andreas. And we're still concerned because this is a region that could in fact produce another magnitude 7.8 earthquake. The reason for the 1857, again, you know, just last year, the long-awaited Hartsfield earthquake occurred, you know, 16 years too late and a day and a year too early for other reasons. But Parkfield occurred. It's a small little earthquake, extremely well recorded. It's a gold mine in terms of understanding maybe what happens in an earthquake. But the problem with Parkfield is that that, in fact, is the epicentral region for the 1857 earthquake. And it's also been the epicentral region for prior earthquakes. And so we're extremely concerned, basically, that this end of Parkfield is now loaded. And again, since 1857, the average slip on the this section, maybe a little bit in here, it's a little bit less, but the average slip over this area is 4.5 meters of slip in 1857. It accumulates slip at 30 or 3 centimeters per year. Well, if you take 3 centimeters per year and you multiply by 150 years, you realize you're back to 4.5 meters. So you're back to what was released in 1857. So this is the reason, in fact, that we sit here and worry about long straight sections perhaps being super sheer. You know, it'll hit a few places like Bakersfield. It depends which way it goes, though, of course, if it takes off and comes the other way. So these are the issues, then, when we're looking at these problems of ground motion and, you know, what's going to happen. Because we may be have underestimated considerably what is the likelihood of very, very strong ground motion near faults. When we have these big earthquakes, because it's only recently that people have begun to discuss the idea that the rupture velocity could be super shear. So thank you.
How do you estimate what to expect as far as the magnitude of the possible quakes? How do you determine
that? The magnitude is computed from the seismic moment, to be honest. And the seismic moment is simply the product of the area of the fault, which we will estimate the length and the down dip. We got a pretty good idea of the depth of most brittle zones, okay, that are going to fail. And the length is sometimes harder to estimate because it depends whether or not two faults will link up. Like Landers was bigger than anybody had estimated before because nobody allowed before Landers the possibility that different links of different faults would actually, that the rupture would jump. Okay, but if you get the length and you get a pretty good idea of the depth or down dip extension of the fault, you've got the area. Then what you have, the modulus is pretty universal. Okay, it's 3 × 10⁻⁰ newtons per meter squared. So that's a pretty universal number. The thing about it is that what you're left with is how much slip. And then the slip is calculated based on when was the last earthquake, if you know it. Because we, on almost all the major plate boundaries, like in Sumatra, we know from a lot of evidence what the rate of convergence is. We don't know when the last earthquake occurred in Sumatra. That was the thing. But everybody knew it's accumulating it at 6 centimeters per year. So in a case like 1857, we know we've got 150 years since the last earthquake. We know we've got 30 millimeters per year of accumulated slip. We know what the length is, and we know what the depth is. So we can calculate pretty much what the magnitude if the whole thing breaks at one time. And the big thing is, why does it stop? In other words, we don't get magnitude 9s. The magnitude 9 earthquake has, I love it, it's upset any number of different computer codes that were hardwired, not, you know, they never even had a magnitude 9. They had no way of inverting for how much slip is it going to occur. But you get these magnitudes big earthquakes occur on well-defined faults. We've never seen an earthquake, you know, occur randomly just break through Nebraska, for example. I mean, just hasn't happened. New Madrid, the thing about it is that they're their faults too. In other words, the faults are well defined. The aftershocks are extremely, and even today, the seismicity. It's not in a plate boundary, but you can get intraplate earthquakes. I mean, you get them in, there's a big one, Meckering, in Australia. But these faults, when they're defined, are, you know, they stay planes of weakness. In other words, even in New Madrid at the present time, that's how they pronounce it, all of today's seismicity still lines up in a very narrow zone. In other words, it's not spread out over the parts of Arkansas and Missouri. but it is very well defined. And in California, the problem with us in California, or and lots of other places as well, we know that 1857 generated this big earthquake, and we know that there's been a big earthquake in 1690 on the southern San Andreas. If you looked at today's seismicity maps, they are the places that are extremely quiet. There's almost no seismicity on these. These things are locked up. We're getting seismicity off the fault, we get them at the ends, but all the earthquakes right now in Southern California aren't on the San Andreas. The big earthquakes since 1906 and 1857, you know, they're in places. 1952 is in Bakersfield, Landers is out in the Mojave, Hector Mines out in the Mojave. All these earthquakes, you know, Northridge is in San Fernando Basin. These earthquakes are not occurring on the San Andreas. It's basically storing up all that plate motion. And so when it goes, you generate this large earthquake. Yes?
How important are the properties of the crust for determining whether a failure occurs and whether it's getting super shear loss?
The properties of the crust are extremely important in the sense of, to a large degree, it has to do you know, judging from my discussions mostly with Eric and looking at these things, is that what you're really looking at is the degree of heterogeneity. In other words, if you've got a smooth rupture going, it will probably stay sub-shear. But if you've got some other way to get energy up into the rupture front that wants to exceed it so that it's traveling at one of these material velocities, then it will try to push it faster. Because the only thing that's controlling the rupture, you know, how fast it's propagating, is the rupture criteria and whether or not it's being met by having stress waves that arrive at that point. And the only waves that can arrive at that point, you know, are going to be these material velocities, but they're adding up. And so if you're close to failure and you get an S wave or a P wave getting there and just tipping it, it'll break. And then what happens is that it gets to be complicated, because I don't know the answer to this, but what happens in between? In other words, we know this rupture is going this way and it wants to go this way, but surely it could want to propagate back. And so locally, you'd have what would appear to be twice the rupture speed. But you know, it's very, it depends a large degree on the heterogeneity. As far as the material, you know, if you had just two homogeneous materials, you know, side by side, then it's also possible that you might be able to do this, because you can get, you know, waves traveling on one side will travel faster than the other material, and you might, in fact, then help or assist in generating a super shear rupture velocity. Well, the simplest. Well, that's okay. That'll disappear. No signal.
Ever travel faster? I mean, if it's jumping by P waves, the crack is never actually going faster. It's just the average velocity is the sum between P waves
lost. It actually does travel faster. In other words, and part of it is
it sounds like it could just jump forward.
It could just jump. But it also can propagate this fast. Okay, typically this is the force system for a dislocation. It's a double couple system, no rotation, and this will cause slip on, let's say, on our strike slip fault. The radiation pattern for the P waves is a four-lobed system like this, a rosette. And in this region, it will compress the mass, and in this region, you'll get a dilation. Okay, this field is set up at the P wave speed. Okay, the criterion for the rupture, you know, the rupture, we're going to put it right here, okay, as it moves across. But this means that this field, you will have more mass here and less here. So you will get another force if you come out to here that will look as if it's going down like this, okay? But this force has to be balanced as well. And so this force, the force that this one will generate as you get the mass, it's going to generate a force that will look like this in front, and then it's going to generate, in order to balance it, generates this force. To balance it, it will have to generate a force like this. But then this force looks like this, this looks like this, and you're back to the same double couple. And this is a perturbation that propagates at the wave speed of the P wave speed. And so this perturbation, pardon? Along the unbroken part. And so this is a perturbation in the stress field that will be generated ahead of it that can, in fact, if it says I'm going to, if it pushes it to the yield criteria, it'll start propagating. And there are other waves that are like this. So this is what I think is happening. In other words, these waves are getting out there. Eric's way is different. In other words, he has basically a diffraction right at the crack tip that then will overtake, you know, another diffraction. Where is Eric? Oh, there he is. I saw him. So one of the ways, when I first was looking at Imperial Valley, it was this idea that I had in mind, that, you know, that how we could ever see anything that was going to be this way, because it's not what you're going to predict. You keep, as you know, sub-shear. You keep it at Rayleigh wave speed or less. And most earthquakes, the average rupture velocity, by far, the average rupture velocity is less. But recently, not just Denali, but Michel Bouchon has shown that for the Izmit earthquake in 1999, the Turkey earthquake, and also for this great earthquake in Tibet, the Kulun Shan earthquake, this earthquake also had super shear rupture velocities on the order of 5.3 kilometers per second. And so these waves are really getting out, you know, that this energy is coming. In the case of Rosakis, it's coming from the other edge of the fault. In other words, it stops. It generates a diffracted wave that travels with the S wave, comes back, reflects across, overtakes the rupture front, and then adds to the energy, you know, that's getting ahead of the crack tip. But the mechanisms are still out there, you know, as to exactly, you know, how you're going to provide the energy into the crack tip.
Is super shear rupture, is that a steady state well-defined
problem? It is.
Well, I think maybe an easy way to understand it is, instead of thinking about it first as a fracture problem, think about it as just some interface, a frictionless interface, and then sort of add friction in later. So start with a frictionless interface and make some perturbation to, like, you know, break one little point there. Then what you'll see is you'll see slip pulses shooting off, and you'll see a slip pulse moving. The front moves at the P wave speed, so there's like a slipping zone between the P and S wave speed. That's one, and that would be, so that would sort of correspond to super shear ruptures. There's, you know, stress waves that are transmitting forces that are causing the slip.
Pretending it's a bulk wave.
Mm-hmm. It's bulk wave, but it has to do with the fact that you have this frictionless interface that's actually in a wave. Like, that's essential. And then you get a second slip pulse sort of coming in behind the Rayleigh wave speed. So that's the conventional sub-shear rupture. And so then by adding in friction, you're basically just adding some dissipation to the problem, and that'll just slow up that rupture. Otherwise, you're pretty fewer with the speed of the slip pulse.
There's no hand waving intuitive explanation for the Rayleigh.
Right, right. Yeah, other questions? Further questions?
Go. How does velocity feed into the design of buildings? I mean, is it directly translated to the impact of the earthquake, or is, I mean, or
oh, you mean the damage and going into the building? There are two ways. One of them basically is that you're doing is you're dumping energy in to the building, and the building's got to absorb this. The other thing is that the buildings themselves are the thing that they're concerned about in these pulses has to do. Interesting problem. Basically, the base of the building starts moving, and then of course it reacts at the top. And then this actually, what you have then is a wave that is traveling up the building back down. If this happens to come down and interfere with the wave that is also of the opposite sign, then all of a sudden you've doubled the direction of the motion, so the force on the bottom of the building is even worse. And what you get then is when you calculate, what ends up calculating is then, what is the strain? In other words, what is the, let's say, what the first story up here is doing relative to the base. And the engineers design, when they design buildings, they have a factor for this. In other words, what they think is the interstory drift, and it's something like 2% at most. And then they might throw in another factor of 2 at most, so you might get 4%. And so what happens is that if the velocity is such that you actually get more than that, basically that floor will decouple. And let's put it this way, there are a couple of records that we now have that if you put them into certain really well-known and very, very famous buildings in San Francisco, you would expect to see the whole thing pancake, because the interstory drift exceeds their design by factors of 2. And people have never expected, you know, these large pulses, because most people design for things that are on the order of 50 or 60 centimeters per second. A meter per second we've seen, not too often, but now we're seeing it more often. And then all of a sudden, you know, we're seeing these large values, and the designs really weren't thinking about values being quite that big. Parkville, this little tiny little earthquake, wonderful in every way because it's so well recorded, has accelerations now that exceed 2.5 g, and they have velocities that are 2 meters per second. And they're not instrument errors or anything like this. And so where are these ground motions coming from? Have we underestimated basically just how big the ground motion? And there's no evidence of super shear in Parkville. It's just, you know, it's pretty fast in some parts, but not over a large part. So they're just issues like this. But if you throw in this other issue about the very, very fast velocities, then you get worried about whether or not you could generate, 6 or 7 meters per second, because nobody has that in their design. 6 meters per second ground motion is just not even heard of. Nobody would even think of that.
What you were saying is not something you said that in that block. What you really are worried about is you get the super shear thing, you get the equivalent of a sonic boom.
You get the equivalent of a sonic boom.
That's what would be so dangerous.
It's essentially, but exactly. But the amplitudes are large on the fault, and the thing about it is that the sonic boom is that they're not attenuated because of this shock, or trouble. Exactly, and that means that they're going to basically be rich in all frequencies. But the thing that Eric has shown very nicely is that this pulse contains is exactly a replication of the slip rate pulse that we have on the fault. That's what's carried in, undistorted to the field. And those pulses, looking at what we see on the faults, we have seen 3 or 4 meters per second. But generally, radiation damping takes care of it, you get rid of it. But if that stays with us, 3 or 4 meters per second to 5 or 10 kilometers, then we have a much bigger swath of land that's going to be hit really, really hard. People are estimating, let's say 2 or 3 kilometers off a fault, and then they start to think, it'll be okay. But you take a place like Hayward, running right, the Hayward Fault running right along the East Bay, all the way through all those cities, and if you start generating a super shear rupture on that segment, Dublin and Pleasant, Walnut Creek and Pleasantville and Dublin, all these places are all Pleasant Valley, all going to get hit. In other words, with the same value that you're going to get close to the fault. So these attenuation properties are another thing too, but it is going to come in very quick, and you get hit with both sides. David.
Now you scared us.
I know.
Did you say something about Santa Barbara?
Santa Barbara, the worst thing about Santa Barbara is that we are, you could call it the worst of the best, okay? From standpoint to beauty, it's the best. We're on the hanging wall of the fault. We get a beautiful view of the ocean, and we're up high. So we're protected from tsunamis. The bad thing is that we're on the hanging wall. And so that means we're sitting above the fault plain, which means that, and I can tell you that we have lots of evidence for this from Chichi earthquake and any number of others. The hanging wall just gets rocked. It does, most of the motion is in the hanging wall. It's not like there's a relative motion where one moves less than the other. The hanging wall does most of the motion, and the intensity of the amplitudes in the hanging wall is always greater than if you're at the foot wall. And so let's say if you were in our good friends to the south in Pasadena, I love it because they all live in Altadena. All the Caltech professors I know all live in Altadena because they want a nice view. But of course they just put themselves on the hanging wall of the Sierra Madre Fault. And the people that actually are going to be safe are those people that are in South Pasadena because they're on the foot wall. And this is exactly what happened in Chichi. There are a large amount of damage in the Chichi earthquake in Taiwan, but the hanging wall was just get shattered rock. If you go and look at the rocks in the hanging wall, most of the time they're just shattered. And the foot wall, it looks relatively undisturbed.
Where is the edge?
The edge? Oh, well, it depends which one you want. The big faults actually, if you look for where the fault would come to the surface, it's in the channel. So they're roughly, the North Channel fault here is about 5 kilometers in the channel where it would outcrop. So it's dipping back, and it's dipping at about 45 degrees, so we're about 5 kilometers above it. We did calculations, incidentally. There's a paper we published, in fact, funded by the Office of the President and our own chancellor and our own facilities management. We did calculations, actually, for the ground motion from a magnitude 6.8 right over here at Geological Sciences. If you want to know how does it compare with the design criteria for the campus, you should take a look at the paper, but it's not good. Because we would estimate that basically 50% of the earthquakes have a chance of exceeding the design spectra.
So what are you talking about, 6.8 on campus?
I don't know what type of damage, but the thing about it is we've talked with the engineers, because we've actually talked with the engineers who do the designs. And the buildings on campus are designed, you know, with two different levels. One of them is a factor of life safety, in which case the buildings are well designed, you're not going to die. But there is another one, which is the operational design. In other words, are you going to be able to use the building? That doesn't look so good, in other words, because it looks like many of the earthquakes, because we had to run a whole suite, so we ran 120 different earthquakes, and I'm not even sure that they're as good as they could be. We could do them better. I don't know if it would lower the ground motion or not. But the thing about it is that in those 120 simulations, what we found is that in the design period, in the design criteria that they use for operational capability, about 50% of the earthquakes will generate ground motion that will exceed the design. If you go to life safety, it's a completely different issue. They have a much stricter design.
Question. Is that true of the brand new buildings on campus, like this one right here and this one right
here? Yes. Because the design criteria that is used, because of the university...
That's what you say, Robin. The lifetimes of buildings for operations in a seismic zone are set by the seismic hazard.
Right.
That's what sets the lifetime of the building.
Yes. Right, exactly, and that's why we have barracks that have been here since 1945, because nobody believes that. I mean, the lifetime of the building of those was supposed to be probably 20 years, and so they're here for, you know, 60. So the thing about it is that it's the hazard is determined for when in the state of art practice for the engineering community, they have to make a design criteria that basically matches or meets what they call state of the art. Okay, and state of the practice. The reason for it is simply liability. And they have to follow those guidelines. And they do those guidelines, and we talked with both the engineers and the architects, and they're two different criteria. But when you look and say, well, are the buildings going to catastrophically fail? The answer is probably no. They're going to stand up. You ask, am I going to be able to get in and use my lab, you know, in 3 months' time? The answer is probably no. In other words, you probably, some of the buildings are going to sustain substantial amount of damage, and they're not going to be usable in a short period of time. But nonetheless, the ultimate objective of all the Uniform Building Code and all the codes that ever preceded it was life safety. It's only been recently that people have now started to talk about performance engineering, performance design. How well can I design something? And the type of buildings that are going through that right now are the ones that you would imagine, namely hospitals. And that's why Cottage is having such a problem, you know, because they have to do all the retrofits, et cetera. Because they have to be operational, period. And that means they're designing everything to a much higher standard. But whether or not our classroom is available, as long as our students, you know, and you and I don't get killed in them, then they actually met the code. And that's why I always tell my students that I never lecture in any hall where I don't have a substantial table in front of me that I can duck under. That's better than most. Because when you look at what damage comes from, most of the time you see things coming from the ceiling. You don't get hurt because the building generally collapses. It's rare in the United States.
Is it safer to be on the second floor?
Do you want to be jumping out the window or you want to come down? Actually, my feeling is that it's probably safer to be on the first floor. And you should know always where the columns are because they're probably going to stand up. So the thing about it is that I don't have as much of a fear of the building failing as you worry about, again, when I give my lectures in my class, the tsunami is a secondary effect. More people died from that than died from any shaking. And so what you worry about in buildings is basically, will you in fact generate a fire? And will then, you know, the stairwell still be up when you want to use them? Yeah. Oh yeah, if your books aren't locked down, you have a chance of being trapped. And I can see that you can imagine the headlines, of course, you know, with such a thing.
Okay, how about maybe one more question? Okay, well, let's thank the speaker.